Although he was upset over everything that had happened that morning, first with Pamela, and then her father, and finally Rebel, Conrad knew he couldn't sit around moping all day. There was still work to do, so he had resumed his efforts of the day before, trying to get all the details of the depot's construction smoothed out so that the building would be ready when the railroad arrived. Deciding to stretch his legs, Conrad walked down the block and turned in at the Big Nugget. Repairs were already underway as men worked to put right the damage that had been done during the brawl the previous night. While the carpenters worked hard, a couple of women knelt on the floor with brushes and buckets of soapy water, trying to scrub up as many of the bloodstains as they could. Even with the work going on, the Big Nugget was open for business. Jonas Wade was behind the bar.
Hello, Jonas.
Conrad, how are you?
Fine. I see it didn't take long to get the repairs started.
Yes. We got going first thing this morning.
Remember, whatever the total of the damages turns out to be, let me know the difference between that and the amount you collected from Tarleton's men, and I'll see to it that you're paid.
I still say that's mighty generous of you.
Think nothing of it. It's only fair. Besides, I intend to be doing business for a long time in Ophir, and I want to get off on the right foot.
I heard that you're not planning to marry the Tarleton girl anymore.
Word's gotten around that quickly, has it?
Well, you weren't exactly discreet about breaking off the engagement with her in the middle of the Holloway House dining room.
Yes, that's certainly true. I might do things differently if I had the chance to try again.
You're not saying you'd still want to marry her?
Not at all.
That might just be a good thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's none of my business. I'm not sure you can trust her father.
Clark Tarleton? He's a very respected businessman.
Maybe so, but when you're around a saloon all the time, you hear things. Hard cases drift in and out, and in the past few days, I've overheard some of them mention Tarleton.
They weren't planning to rob him or anything like that, were they?
Not hardly. From what I heard, it sounded more like those hombres were working for Tarleton.
At his mine, you mean?
These weren't miners. Hired guns were more like it. I never saw them before, but I know the type. I don't know how long they've been here in Ophir either, since I haven't been around that long myself.
Do you know what happened to these men? Are they still around town?
Haven't seen them for a day or two. Could be they drifted on. Either that, or they're off somewhere up to no good. You know, a thought has occurred to me. I've heard about some of the problems you've had during construction.
Word does get around, doesn't it?
Especially in a bar. But what I was thinking was this. You and Tarleton are business rivals. Is it possible that Tarleton has some connection with the sabotage of the spur line?
No, absolutely not. Tarleton might be my rival when it comes to mining, but the man has no connection with railroading. The failure of the spur line would actually hurt Tarleton's business interests, because it would be to his advantage to have rail service to Ophir.
Okay, just thought I'd mention it.
I'm not sure what this is about, Jonas, but it doesn't have anything to do with me.
You're right. Since you're not engaged to Miss Tarleton anymore, I reckon it's none of your business, nor mine.
I appreciate the concern regardless. Remember, let me know about the damages.
I'll do that.
Conrad started back toward the Holloway house. When he arrived, Rebel was waiting for him in the lobby.
Conrad?
He wasn't sure what she was going to say or do. With Rebel, it was always a mystery until it happened. He was ready to duck, though, in case she took a swing at him.
Hello, Rebel.
Perhaps he could mend some fences with her.
About this morning...
Never mind that. I felt a mite sorry for Pamela, believe it or not, but she really is a prissy little thing, and you'd be better off without her.
Does Clark know you feel that way about his daughter?
Why should I care what Clark Tarleton thinks?
Why, I was under the impression that you were quite taken with him.
Oh, hell, I was just... Oh, never mind.
Conrad forced himself not to smile, but he felt his heart leap inside his chest. Rebel had been about to say that she didn't really care about Tarleton. She had just been using him to make Conrad jealous.
Rebel, I really think that we should talk.
That's what I'm trying to do, you jughead. I'm trying to tell you that my brothers and my cousin are in town, and they're still gunning for you.
I know.
You know?
Well, I knew they had come to Ophir. I wasn't sure whether or not they were still carrying a grudge against me.
It damn sure is. He wants you dead almost as much as he wants to kill Frank. Tom and Bob, well, they're not so sure. But they're so used to going along with whatever Ed wants that I'm afraid they're liable to come after you, too.
I've been keeping my eye open for them. In fact, I saw you talking to your brothers a while ago. That's the first time I've seen them since we arrived in Ophir. I haven't seen Ed at all.
That's because he's been denned up in a whorehouse, staying drunk and working up his meanness. But Tom says he's sober now and he's ready to start looking for you and Frank.
There's really no reason for them to be angry with me. I had nothing to do with the deaths of your other cousins.
Oh, they say you kidnapped me.
What? I did nothing of the sort.
Well, actually, you kind of did. I didn't want to go along with you and Frank at first. But that was before I got to know the two of you.
Oh, this is insane. Didn't you tell them that they were wrong about what happened?
Yeah, and I did my best to convince them to stop letting Ed lead them around by the nose. I don't know if it did any good, though.
Perhaps if I had a word with them.
Have you gone completely loco? You need to stay away from them if you can.
Yes, that makes sense. I'll do my best. I won't go hunting trouble.
Conrad dropped his hand to the butt of the Colt Lightning on his hip.
But if it comes to me, I suppose I'll have no choice but to deal with it.
Oh, hell, Conrad. You're no gunfighter. You may be Frank Morgan's son, but you didn't inherit his skill with a Colt.
What? What makes you think that
you're Frank's son? Anybody who's around the two of you for very long could see that. You don't look that much alike except at certain times. But then, suddenly the resemblance is there and you can't miss it. And there are other little things that you both do. Like the way you hold your head when you're interested in something. And the way your eyes squint a little when you laugh. Things like that.
That makes no sense. Why, until I was nearly grown, I never even knew that I...
He stopped short as he realized what he was about to admit.
You never knew that Frank was your father? Doesn't matter all that much whether you were raised around him or not. The things that tie a father and a son together are in the blood. Bonds like that can't be broken, no matter what.
You don't understand. He's completely different from me. He's a gunman. Little better than an outlaw.
I've been around Frank Morgan enough to know that's not true. He's no owl hoot. Never has been.
He caused my mother a great deal of pain. He left her to raise me alone.
You said you didn't know about him. Maybe he didn't know about you.
No, he didn't know about me. But he never tried to find out either. And then, when he came back into my mother's life after all those years, it was her involvement with him that led to her death.
Is that true?
No. It's not. The person really responsible for my mother's death was a lawyer named Charles Dutton, a man who had pretended to be her friend while really betraying her and trying to steal her company. Outlaws hired by Dutton, Ned Pine, and Victor Van Bergen. They were the ones who gunned her down. Frank's presence might have spooked Dutton into acting more hastily than he would have otherwise, but when you get right down to it, Frank wasn't to blame.
The resentment Conrad had felt toward his father had clung stubbornly. He'd been unable to put it aside, even though Frank had never been anything but friendly toward him. Frank had come here to New Mexico territory and put his life on the line for no other reason than to help his son. My God, Conrad thought, he might even love me.
Conrad, what's wrong?
He shook free of her and walked toward the hotel entrance, trying not to stumble. Conrad pawed at his eyes with the back of his hand, and his chest rose and fell rapidly as he tried to catch his breath. Unfamiliar emotions ran riot inside him. He had never been one to admit easily that he was wrong. But when it came to Frank Morgan, he had been wrong for years. Conrad could see that now. With Rebel trailing him with a worried look on her face, he pushed open one of the hotel's double doors and stepped out onto the boardwalk. He needed air. Some instinct made him turn to his right.
Frank!
I thought I'd find you at the nicest place in town.
Utter shock went through him, freezing him as he saw the very man who had just been in his thoughts walking toward him. Frank Morgan was here in Ophir, on the same boardwalk as Conrad. And as Frank saw his son, he smiled and raised a hand. Behind him, Ed Callahan came out of the mouth of an alley and stepped up onto the boardwalk.
Morgan! It's time!
Callahan's hand was poised over the butt of the gun on his hip, ready to hook and draw. Frank reacted to the challenge without missing a beat, stopping and turning smoothly, not hurrying, but not wasting any time either. As he faced Ed Callahan, Rebel's brothers, Tom and Bob, stepped out of the alley where Ed had been waiting and backed up their cousin, spreading out to either side of him. as it always did at moments such as this, time seemed to slow down slightly for Frank Morgan. The world around him receded. All the unimportant details of his surrounding faded away. His attention was centered on the man who wanted to kill him. Every little thing, every blink of the eyes, every tensing of the muscles became vitally important. Frank took note of them all, knowing that watchfulness was as important as speed when it came to surviving a gunfight.
You don't have to do this, Callahan.
The hell, I don't you kill my brothers!
Only because they forced me to. I wasn't going to just stand there and let them kill me.
Those weren't fair fights. Simon and Judd weren't gunslingers. They didn't have a chance against you. I do. I'm a heap faster than they were.
Tom! Bob, please! Don't do this! Just step away!
Damn it, Rebel! Ed's our cousin. He's family. Family's got to stand with family.
Go back inside, Rebel. This don't concern you no more.
The hell it doesn't!
Rebel pushed past Frank and ran toward her brothers, putting her between Frank and Ed. Ed's hand dipped toward his gun, moving with blinding speed.
Damn!
Frank reached for his Colt as he realized what Ed was trying to do. The son of a bitch was using Rebel as a distraction and a shield. Frank's only chance was to fire past her before Ed could get off a shot and risk hitting her.
Rebel, no!
Conrad!
Conrad slammed into Frank's shoulder as he leaped toward Rebel. His arms wrapped around her waist and brought her down. At the same instant, Ed got off the first shot. The peacemaker in Frank's hand bucked twice. Both bullets thudded into Ed Callahan's chest and drove him backward. Instinctively, his cousin Bob grabbed him and kept him from falling.
Oh, God!
But as blood welled out over Bob's fingers from the wounds in Ed's chest, a horrified expression appeared on Bob's face, and he let Ed's limp form slide on down to the street. Conrad and Rebel had landed a few feet in front of Frank and lay there motionless. Frank stayed where he was and held the Colt steady. A dozen feet away, Tom and Bob stood frozen. Tom's hand was on the butt of his gun, but he hadn't drawn the weapon. Bob stared down at the blood on his hands as Ed lay huddled at his feet.
It's up to you, boys. You got it to do if you still want to.
No!
Rebel twisted out of Conrad's grip and pushed herself up.
No! Let go! Didn't you see what just happened here? Ed was willing to shoot me if he had to. He didn't care about me or either of you. He was just using you to help him get Morgan.
Rebel's right, Tom. Ed didn't give a damn about us.
Slowly, the fingers of Tom's gun hand straightened out. He lifted the hand away from the gun.
If family didn't mean nothing to him, then it don't have to mean anything to us either.
I'm your family. Let that mean something for a change.
It's over, Morgan. Ed didn't give you a choice any more than Simon and Judd did. But it's over now. And it'll stay that way. You won't have any more trouble with me and Tom.
Frank nodded and lowered his Colt. He opened the cylinder, thumbed out the empty shells, and replaced them with fresh cartridges from the loops on his gun belt. Then he slid the iron back into leather.
No hard feelings, Morgan?
No. Just regrets that Ed pushed it so far.
The shootout had drawn a lot of attention, with people quickly converging on the spot. The town marshal came hurrying up with a shotgun clutched in his hand. Frank explained what had happened, and since there were plenty of witnesses to back up his story, including Conrad Browning, the lawman nodded in acceptance.
Don't know if there'll be an inquest or not. That'll be up to the county sheriff and the coroner. Will you be around for a while, just in case there's a hearing, Mr. Morgan?
I may not be in town. But I'm not planning on leaving the area anytime soon.
It's good enough for me. Too bad it had to come to this. I've seen too much of Diane in the years I've been wearing a badge.
We all seen too much of Diane.
Frank waited until the crowd broke up, and Ed Callahan's body had been carted off in the undertaker's wagon. Rebel was still talking to her brothers, so Frank took advantage of the opportunity to draw Conrad aside.
You could have gotten killed, jumping into the middle of things like that.
I'm sorry. I know I could have gotten you killed. But when I saw that Rebel was in danger, I just didn't stop to think. I had to save her.
Does she know how you feel about her?
Well, I've wanted to tell her, but it's complicated. There was all that business with Pamela.
Who?
That's right. You don't even know about her. Or her father.
No. I reckon I'm lost.
It's a long story. It looks like Rebel's going to be busy with her brothers for a while, so why don't we go over to the Big Nugget and have a drink? I can tell you all about it there. I'm sure Jonas Wade would like to say hello to you.
Jonas Wade? The gambler I ran into back in El Paso?
That's right. He owns the Big Nugget Saloon now.
Huh. Sounds like everybody's been mighty busy while I was poking around the mountains and getting captured by saboteurs and Apaches.
What?
Come on, let's get a drink. We can tell each other all about it.
By the time an hour had passed, both Frank and Conrad had been brought up to date on each other's activities while they were apart. They sat at a table in a corner of the Big Nugget with Jonas Wade, nursing mugs of beer as they filled each other in.
A man gets tired of moving around. Ophir's a mighty nice place. I aim to settle here.
I can understand that. They may call me the Drifter. That doesn't mean I haven't thought about settling down, too.
Why don't you? Marshal Everett's getting on in years and will probably retire soon. I know the town council would be thrilled to give you the job.
Oh, I've worn a badge before. It's not something I'd care to do again.
So do something else. Buy a ranch. Maybe raise some horses.
Someday.
Frank knew perfectly well that day would probably never come.
Someday, I might just do that. Right now, though, I'm more interested in this fella Tarleton. Are you sure those gunslicks you overheard were talking about him?
I'm certain. I was surprised to hear hombres like that talking about a man like Tarleton, so I paid particular attention. It sounded to me like they were working for him.
That makes no sense. I know what you're thinking, Frank, but Clark Tarleton owns a mine near here. The railroad coming to Ophir will benefit him, too. You wouldn't be interested in stopping my spur line from getting through?
Unless he's a member of the syndicate that owns the Southwestern and Pacific. You said yourself he has a lot of different business interests, and he's from Philadelphia. That fella Shear told me the syndicate has offices in Philadelphia and Boston.
I have offices in Boston. That doesn't make me one of the syndicate.
No, but I don't think we can rule out Tarleton's involvement. After all, he's right here in Ophir, where Royal and those other gunmen could report to him on the sly.
It's just difficult for me to believe, that's all. But I suppose you're right. We have to consider the possibility. What's our next move?
Shear's life is in my hands. I'm convinced the attack on Mono Rojo's people was carried out by Royal and his bunch. If they're working for Tarleton, we've got to spook them into coming out into the open somehow, so that the connection will be exposed.
How do we do that?
If you could figure out some way to talk to Tarleton again, tell him that the spur line's route is going to be changed. Tell him it's going to angle to the west after it crosses the gorge and go through the natural cut in the ridge.
How's that going to do us any good?
I got a pretty good look at that ridge while I was with Shear. The cut in it is a deep one, and the wall on the east side bulges out quite a bit.
Yes, that's why Nathan decided not to route the tracks through there. Too much danger of rock slides, or of that whole side of the cut collapsing one of these days. We wouldn't want it to fall on one of our trains.
Of course not. But if you told that to Tarleton, and then something was to happen, like an explosion that blew down the wall of that cut, say, then we'd know it had to be Tarleton who gave Royal the orders.
By God, you're right. I hate to think that he's capable of such a thing, but we have to find out.
And if nothing happens, we've cleared Tarleton as a suspect.
All right, I'll do it. I'm not sure how I'll manage to have the conversation with him, since we're on the outs at the moment, but I'll think of something.
Don't waste any time. I just have a week to uncover the ringleader before those Apaches kill Shear.
You're hoping that once we have the goods on Tarleton, if he's guilty, he'll confess to being behind the attack on the Apaches, too?
If he's guilty, he'll tell us the truth about all of it. One way or the other.
Good Lord. What's a lady like her doing in here?
Frank and Conrad looked toward the entrance of the Big Nugget, as Wade was doing, and Frank saw why the saloon keeper was surprised. A very attractive red-headed woman, about 30 years old, had just pushed through the bat wings and now paused there, looking around. But when her gaze lit on Frank, Conrad, and Jonas Wade, she smiled and started straight across the room toward them.
Mrs. McShane, it's good to see you again. Were you looking for me?
For your friend, Mr. Morgan, actually. Are you Frank Morgan, sir?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Allison McShane. I'm the editor and publisher of the Ophir Ledger.
Glad to meet you, Mrs. McShane.
I heard about the unfortunate incident in front of the hotel. Would you care to comment on it?
No, I don't believe I would. It's over, and I'd like to leave it that way.
Then perhaps you'd consent to a more wide-ranging interview. I'd like to inform the readers of the Ledger that a famous man is in our midst.
Frank hesitated. He had been interviewed by journalists many times, but seldom by one as pretty as this Allison McShane. Never, come to think of it.
I appreciate it, but I don't reckon that would be a good idea.
I disagree. I think the readers would be very interested.
Sorry, no.
Well, I tried.
Something about her made Frank think that she wasn't giving up so easily, though. She would bide her time and try again.
So, this is what a saloon looks like.
Oh, yes, ma'am. You've never been in one before?
Do I look like the sort of woman who would frequent saloons?
Oh, no, ma'am, you don't. I meant no offense.
None taken. Why are so many people staring at me?
I reckon it's because they're not used to seeing a lady of your quality in here, Mrs. McShane. I'm not sure Mr. McShane would be happy about it either.
There is no Mr. McShane. I'm a widow.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
No apology necessary. You couldn't have known. Are you certain you won't reconsider about that interview?
I'm sure.
Ah, well, that's journalism's loss, I suppose. Good day, Mr. Morgan, Mr. Browning, and Mr...
Jonas? Wade? Ma'am? Let me see you out.
Thank you. You're a gentleman, despite your profession.
Yes, ma'am.
Jonas needs to put his eyes back in his head. Can't really blame him for being impressed, though. Mrs. McShane is a mighty pretty woman.
And a persistent one. She'll ask you for that interview again.
I figured as much. I might give one to her if we can get this business with the railroad cleared up first.
After making sure that Stormy and Wolf were well cared for at the livery, Frank headed for the hotel, intending to get some supper in the dining room. As he came into the lobby, though, he saw Conrad coming toward him. The younger man's face lit up in a grin as he saw Frank.
I did it. I talked to Tarleton.
That was fast. How did you work it?
I approached him as a businessman and told him that we could still help each other to make money, despite the fact that I'm no longer going to marry his daughter. I talked to him about freight rates once the spur line reaches Ophir.
Pretty smart. Sounds reasonable enough. And it gave you an excuse to mention the change in the route, I reckon.
Exactly.
First thing in the morning, I'll ride back out to the construction camp. Sam Brandt needs to be told what's going on. Then we just have to wait and see what happens.
What if Tarleton doesn't do anything right away? It'll still take time to finish that trestle, so he may not think he needs to take any action yet.
Before I left camp, I talked to Brandt about getting started on the tracks on this side of the gorge, while the trestle work was still going on. If Tarleton's men see that and report it to him, he may decide to go ahead and have that cut blown up now.
You sound more convinced than ever that Tarleton's behind everything.
It makes sense. The simplest answer is always the one that's most likely to be true.
Well, I hope you're right. I'm ready to see an end to this trouble.
So am I.
Frank left early the next morning, riding south toward the construction camp. Stormy was glad for the chance to really stretch his legs, and they made good time, arriving at the camp in the middle of the afternoon. On the way in, Frank saw that Sam Brandt had adopted his suggestion and had men carry rails and cross ties over the river and start laying them on the roadbed to the north of the gorge. It was slow work, though, and only 100 yards or so of the track had been laid. If Nathan Buckhalter began surveying a route that curved from the present one and went through the cut in the ridge, it would certainly look like the railroad was about to swing in that direction, too. Brandt spotted Frank and waved at him.
Welcome back, Frank. The boys have just about given up on you, but I figured you were still around somewhere.
I've been a far piece, all right. Around in the mountains and all the way to Ophir and back. Has there been any trouble while I was gone?
Not a bit. You must have scared those bastards off.
It'd be nice to think so, but I know that's not the case.
Frank inclined his head toward the railroad office car.
Let's go to where we can talk in private. I got a lot to tell you.
Sure thing, Frank.
That put a worried frown on Brandt's rugged face. He stalked up to the top of the path to the railroad office car, with Frank following close behind. Once they were inside the superintendent's car, Frank explained everything that had happened since he rode out a few days earlier. Brandt's expression grew more worried the longer Frank talked.
I know that fella Shear. I know of him, I suppose I should say. Never actually met him. I don't think you should trust anything that somebody who works for the SW&P tells you.
He didn't have any reason to lie about anything. And there was certainly nothing fake about what that bunch of hired killers was doing to him.
Yeah, I guess you're right about that.
What about Tarleton? Have you ever heard any rumors connecting him to the rival railroad?
No, can't say as I have. That doesn't necessarily mean anything, though. I work out in the field, not in the offices. Always have.
Can you get Nathan Buckhalter to cooperate and make it look like you're changing the route?
Sure, Nathan will do whatever I tell him to. He was right about the route in the first place, though. That cut's just too dangerous. The fact that Shear thinks the track should go through there is typical of the way the SW&P cuts corners to save a little money.
Don't worry. You won't have to really lay tracks through there. I think Tarleton will act before it ever gets to that point.
You're right. Some more of that stolen dynamite in the right place, and that whole wall of rock would come down and close off the cut for good.
What's that?
Supply train coming in from Lordsburg with a whole new shipment of dynamite to replace the stuff those sons of bitches stole and blew up. We've been waiting on the stuff. Now we can pick up the pace a little. First thing in the morning, we'll move it well away from the camp and cache it. And this time, it'll be well guarded around the clock.
Good idea.
Since the gunfight in front of the Holloway house had been a rather harrowing experience, Conrad figured that Rebel might need a little time to get over it. He didn't approach her until late the following afternoon, when he went to her room in the hotel and knocked on the door. When she opened it, he thought he saw pleasure in her eyes for a second, but then it was replaced by a look of wariness.
What do you want?
I think we need to clear the air between us.
Clear the air about what?
Conrad looked past Rebel and saw her brothers. Tom sat in an armchair, while Bob perched on the edge of the bed.
Oh, your brothers are here.
Where else would they be?
I assumed they had rooms in one of the other hotels or boarding houses in town.
As a matter of fact, we do. But we came over here to talk to Rebel about what we're going to do next.
That's right. We ain't got a ranch to go back to no more, so we got to figure out where we want to go.
Or if we want to stay here. We're good hands, and there are several ranches hereabouts. With all the miners that need feeding, there's a good beef market.
That's true. But what would you do, Rebel?
I can make a hand, too. Bound to be some rancher who'll hire me.
Maybe you could stay here in town. I reckon Mr. Browning here would like that.
Yeah, since he wants to court you and all.
You hush that up. Nobody said anything about courting.
Well, he better. Or else we're liable to get a mite suspicious of his intentions. And seeing as how we're your brothers, we might just have to give him a whipping if he don't mean to do right by you.
Is there some place we could go and talk privately?
I sure hope so. Let's get away from these two. They've gone plumb loco.
It's almost supper time. There's a restaurant in the next block. Why don't we try it instead of the hotel dining room for a change?
Sounds good to me.
As they left the hotel and started down the boardwalk, Conrad took a chance and linked his arm with hers. She didn't pull away, and he took that as an encouraging sign.
You know, you could stay here in Ophir. I'm sure you could get a job.
Oh, doing what? Being a maid or a cook in the hotel? Clerking in some store? That's not the sort of thing I want to spend my life doing.
Actually, I was thinking that perhaps you could work for me. Once the railroad goes through, I'll be spending a lot of time here, and I'll need a capable assistant.
Work? For you? I don't think so.
You wouldn't even consider it?
That just wouldn't work out, Conrad. Trust me on that.
All right. I'm sure we can come up with something.
I'll think on it.
Mr. Browning! Good evening, Mr. Browning. Miss Callahan.
What can we do for you, Mrs. McShane?
Night had fallen, and Conrad was eager to sit down to supper with Rebel.
I've been looking for Mr. Morgan. I'd still like to persuade him to let me conduct an interview with him. But I can't seem to find him anywhere in town.
He rode out early this morning.
On business?
Conrad hesitated. He didn't want to go into detail about what Frank was doing or where he had gone. But for all her gentility, Allison McShane was like a bulldog once she got her jaws locked on something. As it turned out, Conrad didn't have to come up with an answer. Three dark shapes moved out of an alley mouth behind her.
Hold it, Browning. Don't move.
Conrad's hand dropped toward the butt of the Colt Lightning on his hip. He didn't know if these men intended to rob him or kidnap him, But since Rebel and Mrs. McShane were with him, he had to protect them. It was an instinctive reaction. He didn't get a chance to draw the gun. With a rush of footsteps from the other direction, two men jumped him. Brilliant lights exploded inside Conrad's brain like 4th of July rockets, followed by a sweeping tide of blackness. The shocked women froze in horror as Conrad fell, and they were quickly grabbed and gagged before they could even call out. Frank was restless that night as he slept in Brant's railroad car. Some instinct had him on edge, and even though he couldn't explain it, he knew better than to ignore it. When he came awake, far into the night, he sat up in the bunk he was using and looked around in the darkness. Snoring came from several of the other bunks. Then he heard again what must have woken him. Through the open window beside him came the sound of growling. Wolf was supposed to be sleeping outside the car, but something was bothering the big cur. Frank trusted Wolf's instincts and senses as much as he trusted his own. He swung his legs off the bunk, pushed his feet down into his boots, and stood up. Quickly, he buckled on his gun belt. Thinking that he ought to wake Sam Brant in case there really was some threat to the camp, he stepped across the aisle and reached down to give the superintendent's shoulder a shake. But Brant wasn't there. The construction boss's bunk was empty. Frank walked quietly to the back of the car, eased the door open, and stepped out onto the platform. He dropped lithely to the ground.
What's wrong, old boy?
Wolf turned toward the siding where the freight car and the flat cars were parked.
Quiet.
Frank and Wolf started toward the siding. Helped by the sound of the river echoing off of a nearby boulder, they moved quietly through the shadows. Frank's jeans and dark blue shirt made it more difficult to see him in the darkness, and he was grateful for that. Before he reached the siding, he heard something else that surprised him. A low rumbling sound from the tracks beyond the cars. The locomotive that had brought the supplies was getting up steam again. Frank glanced at the sky. The stars told him it was well after midnight, but it wouldn't be dawn for a couple of hours yet. If the locomotive was pulling out for Lordsburg, it was getting a mighty early start. But he supposed that was possible, and it might explain why Sam Brant wasn't in his bunk as well. Then the next moment, Frank tensed again as he heard voices and realized that he hadn't been suspicious enough.
Damn it, why'd you bring them out here? Why didn't you just kill them in town?
Because that's not what the boss ordered us to do. And since he's your boss too, you can take it up with him, I reckon.
The first voice belonged unmistakably to Sam Brant. The second one was less familiar, but the circumstances under which Frank had heard it before meant that he was unlikely to forget it. The second man was Royal, the leader of the gang that had been carrying out the sabotage. Brant was a traitor, working against Conrad and the railroad. That was hard to believe. Frank had liked and trusted the man. Everyone made mistakes sometimes, though, even the Drifter. Frank eased his gun out of its holster and slid through the shadows, moving closer to the car that held the dynamite shipment. He saw several dark shapes standing there, shapes that were men.
Who's that woman, anyway?
Hell if I know. She was with the Browning kid when we grabbed him, along with that girl. Tarleton told us to bring all of them out here and turn them over to you. He said you could get rid of them so that nobody would ever know what happened to him.
Now Frank had to be more careful than ever. Not only did he have to worry about starting a gunfight around that dynamite, but he also had to think about the safety of the prisoners.
Yeah, I know what to do with them. Open the door of that freight car and toss them inside. There's enough dynamite in there to blow practically this whole camp to kingdom come. And if they're on top of it when it goes off, there won't be enough of them left for anybody to ever find. Nobody can prove we had a thing to do with their disappearance.
Frank's blood felt like ice water in his veins as he listened to Brant. The traitor planned to set off a third explosion, the biggest blast of them all. From the sound of what Brant had in mind, the explosion would kill most of the workers and destroy all the supplies. It would be a setback that the New Mexico, Rio Grande, and Oriental couldn't overcome, especially if its principal owner, Conrad Browning, was also dead. Brant and Tarleton would win. Carefully, so that it wouldn't make too much noise, one of the hired killers slid back the door of the freight car.
Damn! How many crates of dynamite you got in here?
Enough. Enough to do the job. I made sure that extra cases were sent up from Lordsburg.
Frank wasn't sure how Brant intended to explain how he survived the blast. Then the answer came to him. The locomotive. Brant was going to take the engine and pull it back out of the range of the giant explosion. He could claim that he was going back to Lordsburg on the railroad's business, and no one would be alive to deny the story. The locomotive had only an engineer and a fireman on it, and Brant could pay them off if he hadn't already, or even kill them to keep them quiet. One by one, three bodies were lifted from the ground and heaved into the freight car with the dynamite.
All right, get the hell out of here. I'll give you time to get away and then light the fuse. Steam's up in the engine, so it won't take me long to pull out either.
All right, Brant. Tell Tarleton we'll be waiting in the usual place for the rest of our money.
I'll tell him.
Royal and the half-dozen men with him began to drift away into the night. Frank waited for them to leave. A pitched gun battle was the last thing he wanted right now. Stray bullets might penetrate the walls of that freight car and strike Conrad or one of the women. Or worse, hit some of that dynamite and set it off. Frank couldn't take that chance. Royal and his men could be rounded up later. When Royal and his men were gone, Brant fished out a lucifer and snapped it to life on his thumbnail. The sudden flare of the match lit up his face for a second.
Drop the match, Sam.
Morgan!
That's right, Sam. And I heard enough to know what you've been up to and what you're about to do.
Better back off, gunfighter. All I have to do is touch this match to the fuse and the whole place blows up.
Not quite. I imagine that's a pretty slow-burning fuse. Go ahead and light it. I'll have plenty of time to kill you and then come put it out.
Maybe. If I light the end of it.
Brant did something then that Frank didn't expect. He flipped the burning lucifer through the gap, into the freight car. At the same instant, his other hand came up, gripped the door, and slammed it shut. Brant lunged to the side, twisting and clawing a gun out of his pocket. Frank fired, but Brant was moving, and while the bullet clipped him and made him stagger, it didn't bring him down. Brant returned the fire. Frank was forced to dive behind a nearby stack of cross ties for cover. Then Brant was off and running toward the engine, while Frank had no idea whether the fuse was burning, or if it was, how close it was to the dynamite. They might be minutes or even bare seconds away from a blast that would be the end of the world for anyone unlucky enough to be caught in it. Frank had no choice. He jammed his Colt back in its holster, scrambled over the pile of ties, and sprinted toward the freight car. With his heart slugging in his chest, Frank reached up, grabbed the door of the freight car, and pulled. The door slid on its tracks, banging back against the stops. Brant's toss had been a good one. The lucifer had landed on the fuse only a couple of feet from where it was attached to a box of blasting powder. The small explosion that would result from that would set off a much larger one as it spread to the crates of dynamite. Frank grasped the floor of the freight car and levered himself up and in. On his knees, he lunged across the intervening space and reached desperately for the fuse. His hand closed around the burning end, smothering the sparks with his bare flesh. Still on his knees, he turned to Conrad, Rebel, and Allison. A quick check told him that they were all alive and seemed to be all right, except for being knocked out and tied up. Leaving them where they were, he slid out of the car and dropped to the ground beside the tracks. The locomotive was gone, backing away from the camp with a chugging and puffing of its engine. Brant was getting away. Frank ran toward the makeshift corral where the horses were kept. A whistle alerted Stormy that he was on his way, and the big Appaloosa was ready, tossing his head in anticipation. Frank threw the gate open, ran inside, and swung up bareback. There was no time for a saddle and tack. Stormy burst out of the corral and launched into a gallop, obeying the commands that Frank communicated with his knees and heels. Frank grabbed the Appaloosa's mane and held on. Men were already coming out of their tents and yelling questions in response to the shots that had been fired a couple of minutes earlier. They would see the door of the freight car standing open and would find Conrad and the women. Meanwhile, Frank sent Stormy racing along beside the railroad tracks as the locomotive continued to back away. It was picking up speed now, even going backward. As Frank drew closer, he saw spurts of orange flame from the cab. Brant must have spotted him giving chase and was firing at him. Frank leaned forward over Stormy's neck, making himself a smaller target. Stormy stretched his legs, pouring every bit of his speed and stamina into the pursuit. The gap between horse and locomotive dwindled. Frank could almost feel Stormy reach down inside himself and bring up one last burst of speed. They were alongside the engine when Brandt triggered more shots from the cab. Frank returned the fire and saw sparks fly as his bullets spanged off the metal sides of the cab. Frank holstered his Colt, reached out for the nearest grab iron, and swung himself off Stormy's back and into the cab. His boots had barely touched the floor of it when Brandt lunged at him, swinging the fireman's shovel. Frank ducked under it. The shovel hit the brake lever and knocked it forward. With a shriek of metal against metal, the speeding locomotive began to slow. Frank lunged at Brandt while the man was off balance from the missed blow with the shovel, and Brandt didn't go down. Brandt smacked the handle of the shovel against Frank's head. Dizzy from the blow, Frank fell to the floor of the cab. He rolled to the side as Brandt tried again to bash his brains out with the shovel. Lifting his leg, Frank kicked Brandt in the hip, knocking him toward the controls at the front of the cab as the train finally lurched to a stop. Brandt hit the throttle and knocked it wide open. The train began to lumber forward. Brandt slashed back and forth with the shovel, aiming the blows at Frank's head. Frank barely avoided them, and finally managed to reach out and grab Brandt's ankle. He heaved as hard as he could, and Brandt went over backward and landed hard on the floor of the cab. Frank reached for his Colt, but it was gone. It had slipped out of the holster sometime during the fight. Frank lunged at Brandt instead, swinging his fist. The punch landed solidly as Brandt tried to get up. Both men sprawled across the cab. They surged to their feet at the same time and stood there slugging away at each other. From the corner of his eye, Frank saw that the locomotive was barreling through the construction camp. The siding where the freight car full of dynamite was parked flashed past. Men ran along the tracks, waving their arms and yelling, although Frank couldn't hear them over the rumble of the engine. Brandt landed a punch that slammed Frank back against the coal tender. Brandt bent and snatched a gun from the floor. Frank knew it was his peacemaker.
You ruined everything, Morgan. But at least you'll die!
Brandt! The trestle!
No!
Brandt's eyes widened with terror as he realized what was about to happen. He dropped the gun, then spun around and lunged toward the controls. At the same moment, Frank leaped from the cab, sailing out into the air, taking his chances this way. He had a last glimpse of Brandt inside the cab, leaning against the brake lever. Sparks shot from the drivers as a metallic scream, like the unholy wail of a banshee, filled the air. But it was too late. The locomotive reached the end of the tracks and plunged out onto the unfinished trestle, which buckled under the huge weight. For an instant, the locomotive seemed to leap out into the yawning emptiness of the gorge. No! Then it plunged down, taking Sam Brandt with it. Frank saw it from the bush at the edge of the gorge, where he hung with his feet dangling. He had been able to grab the bush as he fell after his leap from the cab of the runaway locomotive. A ball of fire blossomed in the rocks along the river as the locomotive and the tender slammed into them. Frank looked down and thought that while the explosion was only a fraction of the size of the one that Brandt had planned, it was still a fitting end for the traitor. Then he started to climb, pulling himself up from the edge of the gorge. He wasn't to the top yet when a hand reached down from above and clamped strongly around his wrist.
Let me help you, Dad.
Clark Talton was seated in the lobby of the Holloway House when Frank walked into the hotel the next afternoon. The industrialist and mining magnate was reading a copy of the Ophir Ledger, and he didn't seem to notice Frank at first. Finally, though, Talton lowered the paper and looked over it at the man standing in front of him, and his eyes grew wide with shock.
Thought I was dead, didn't you, Tarleton? I'm not. Neither are Conrad, Rebel, or Mrs. McShane. But Sam Brandt is, and so is Royal. Brandt died last night out at the construction camp, and Royal went down this morning when him and his gang were paid a visit by a posse that Marshal Everett put together on the quiet, so you wouldn't hear about it and take off for the tall and uncut. I wanted at least one more witness who would testify against you, and we got more than that. Royal's bunch put up a fight, but several of them surrendered when they figured out they were trapped. They talked, Tarleton. And they talked a lot. They told us all about how you had men posted at heliograph stations between here and the camp, so you and Brandt could talk to each other by flashing Morse code from one station to the next. That's how you gave Brandt his orders. Pretty slick setup. In the end, though, it wasn't enough.
You're insane, sir. I don't even know you.
I think you do. I'm Frank Morgan.
You're a madman as far as I'm concerned.
Bluff all you want. I heard Brandt and Royal admit last night that they were working for you. I reckon when the authorities here get in touch with the ones back east, they'll find out pretty quick-like that you own part of the Southwestern and Pacific Railroad. You may own all of it through some dummy companies, for all I know. You had plenty of reason for wanting Conrad's spur line to fail, so your railroad could take it over. That motive and the testimony of the men who are in custody will be enough to put you behind bars for a long time, Tarleton.
Tarleton folded the paper and slapped it against his thigh. His eyes cut first one way, then the other.
Thinking about making a run for it? I wouldn't advise it.
I know who you are. You're a gunfighter. I'd have no chance against you. I won't fight you.
Frank held up his right hand. There was a burn on the palm.
I can still draw, but I'd rather not until this heals up. That's why I brought along some help, just in case you started a ruckus.
Come along, Clark. The marshal is waiting for you. He'll be spending some time in his jail until the sheriff can get up here from Lordsburg to take custody of you.
Conrad, how can you do this? You can't believe this madness. You and I were friends.
Not really. You tried several times to have me killed.
My God, how could you believe that? You were going to marry my daughter.
You never would have allowed that to happen. You've had me marked for death for a long time.
I won't go to jail.
You don't have any choice in the matter.
Hell, I don't.
And with that, Talton lunged forward, swinging a fist at Conrad's head. Conrad leaned to the side, letting the blow go harmlessly past his ear. Conrad stepped in closer and hooked a right to Talton's midsection. The punch knocked the breath out of Talton, but he managed to grab Conrad and barreled into him, knocking him over backward. Both men crashed to the floor of the lobby. Conrad was stunned, but he had the presence of mind to heave his back up off the floor, throwing Talton off balance. Talton fell to the side, still gasping for air. Conrad rolled over and came to his feet, beating Talton by a couple of seconds. He could have stepped in and struck as Talton was struggling to his feet, but he held back, letting his opponent get upright again before he waded in. Conrad landed a couple of hard punches, but Talton shrugged off the blows and threw a hard left and right of his own. Catching his balance, Conrad drove a straight right into Talton's mouth. Conrad didn't let up now. Sledging punches that pushed Talton back across the lobby and into the registration desk. By now, quite a crowd had begun to gather. Rebel and her brothers stood just inside the door of the hotel, along with Allison McShane, Jonas Wade, and Marshal Steve Everett. Wade was holding Allison's hand, and she didn't seem to mind. More of the townspeople pushed in to watch Conrad and Talton slugging away at each other. Suddenly, a scream came from the staircase leading down to the lobby from the second floor. Conrad's head jerked around. He saw Pamela Talton standing there, hands pressed to her face in horror, a look of disbelief in her eyes. The distraction gave Tarleton a chance. Tarleton pressed his attack, obviously intent on making Conrad pay for helping to ruin all his plans. Tarleton drew his leg back to deliver a devastating kick to his fallen opponent. Conrad twisted out of the way, though, heaved on the leg, and brought the older man crashing down. Scrambling onto his knees, Conrad threw himself forward and got his hands around Tarleton's neck. He bounced Tarleton's head off the floor and then started throttling the life out of him. Frank stepped forward, got hold of his son, and pulled Conrad up and off the now senseless Tarleton.
Let go of me, Frank!
That's enough. You don't want to kill him.
Oh, you're wrong about that. Right now, I'd like very much to kill him, but I won't. We'll let the law handle him.
Wise decision, youngster.
Marshal Everett stepped up, bent over, and snapped his handcuffs around Tarleton's wrists. Then he motioned to some of the townsmen.
A couple of you fellas take him down to the hoosegow. I'll be along in a minute to lock him up.
Conrad turned toward the stairs, where Pamela still stood staring at him.
I'm sorry it had to be this way, Pamela. I truly am. Hurting you was something I never wanted to do.
Go to hell, Conrad Browning!
Rebel started toward Pamela, a fighting gleam in her eyes. Frank moved to intercept her.
It's all over. I reckon Conrad could use a gentle hand right about now. He won the fight, but he took quite a bit of punishment along the way.
Rebel glared at Pamela for a second longer, then turned to Conrad and smiled.
Your pa's wrong about one thing. I think I'm the winner here.
You sure you want to boss this job yourself?
I can handle it. At least until my new construction superintendent can get here.
Well, good luck.
Conrad gripped Frank's hand firmly.
Thank you. Thank you for everything.
He started to turn toward the street, where Inferno waited and where Rebel was already mounted on her chestnut. Then he paused.
Frank? Dad? Did I do all right?
You did fine, son. You did just fine.
Conrad nodded, mounted up, and turned his horse toward the south. Rebel was right beside him as the two of them rode away.
What's that in your eyes, Frank?
Damn, dusty road is all. It's been a busy week.
I'll say. Tarleton's in Lordsburg now, isn't he?
Yep. He's waiting trial on a multitude of charges.
And things went okay with the Apaches, right?
They did. I was able to bring Walt Shear back alive. And Mono Rojo is satisfied that justice was done. I think he and the rest of his tribe are going to follow Geronimo's example, turn themselves into the army.
That's a wise decision. I'd hate to see them just exterminated.
You're right. His people have already suffered enough tragedy.
Whatever happened to that highfalutin, Pamela Tarleton?
On her way back to Philadelphia, thanks to Conrad.
I'll be. He went ahead and paid for her trip, did he?
Yeah. Rebel was none too happy about it, though. But I knew Conrad wouldn't leave a lady in distress like that. He's too much of a gentleman.
I hear Rebel's brothers are working out at the construction camp.
They are. They're hunting fresh meat to keep the workers properly fed.
Well, that was nice of Conrad.
By the way, Jonas, I finally gave that Mrs. McShane the interview she was asking for.
Oh? That's good.
I asked a couple of questions of my own, too.
That so?
Turns out she wouldn't mind at all being courted by the owner of a saloon.
Really? No fooling?
That's what she told me. Say, looks like a little of that damn dusty road's gotten into your eyes too, Jonas.
I'll talk to you later, Frank.
Frank leaned on the railing along the boardwalk in front of the hotel and watched the dwindling figures of Conrad and Rebel as they rode out of Ophir. Lifting his right hand, Frank looked at the palm. The burn he had gotten when he snuffed out that fuse was almost healed now. Another few days and he would be able to draw a gun as well as ever. But he hoped he would never have to. The past few weeks had been packed full of excitement and danger, but he was getting too old for these rowdy dows. Seeing Conrad and Rebel together made him think again about grandchildren. The time was coming for him to settle down. A man riding past the hotel caught Frank's attention. The man was roughly dressed and had a lean, wolf-like quality about him. He wore a gun strapped low on his thigh. He was looking at Frank with mean, narrowed eyes, eyes that glittered with recognition.
Later today, or tomorrow at the latest, Frank, this guy'll be your next challenge.
Frank sensed that the stranger fancied himself good with a gun, and the thoughts that had gone through his head as he recognized Frank were plain to read on his face. He figured he was going to be the man who finally outdrew and gunned down the drifter. What was that old saying? The more things changed, the more they stayed the same. Frank drew in a deep breath. The mountain air was crisp and clean, but he thought he smelled a faint hint of gun smoke in it before he realized that the scent clung to him. In Lordsburg's jail that night, Clark Tarleton lay on a hard, uncomfortable bunk and wondered just how everything had gone wrong, as he had wondered every night for the past week. Luck had always been with him, but now it seemed to have deserted him. He would get it back. He would win in the end, he told himself. He always had. He had plenty of money to hire the best lawyers in the country. No prosecutor in some backwater territory would put him behind bars permanently. Besides, he had friends, powerful friends, who would come to his aid. They couldn't afford to do otherwise, because he knew as much incriminating information about them as they knew about him. It was only a matter of time before he was free. Footsteps sounded in the corridor that ran through the center of the cell block. Other than that, the place was quiet. The footsteps came to a stop outside the door of Tarleton's cell. One of the guards checking on him. Tarleton swung his legs off the bunk and stood up, seeing the dark bulk of the man through the bars. The only light in the cell block was all the way down at the other end of the corridor, so the visitor's face was in shadow.
Well, what is it?
Tarleton.
Yes, damn it, man, speak up!
I've got a message for you from a friend. A friend back in Boston.
Tarleton stepped closer to the bars.
Damn well about time.
The stranger's hand came up from his side, and for a second, Tarleton couldn't comprehend that the man held a knife. Then, as understanding dawned on him, he opened his mouth and tried to shout in alarm. Before any words could form, however, the man's hand shot between the bars, grabbed Tarleton's shirt, and yanked him forward. The razor-sharp blade sank easily into Tarleton's throat, cutting off any outcry. The stranger yanked the knife to the side, opening a huge wound. He stepped back quickly as blood spurted. Tarleton fell to his knees, clawing at the bars as he went down. Tarleton's grip on the bars slipped and he fell over backward. A dark pool formed and widened around his head as he twitched a few times and then lay still. The stranger squatted and reached through the bars one more time, wiped the blade clean on one leg of Tarleton's trousers, and then walked quietly out of the cell block without looking back. The next day, in an office in Boston, a door opened and a clerk came in. He laid a telegram on the desk belonging to the man whose office this was. The man picked up the telegram, read the words printed on it, and nodded.
Thank you, Harding.
The man at the desk leaned back in his chair and steepled his fingers in front of him. It would have been better, of course, if everything had worked out and Tarleton had handled his part of the plan successfully. But he hadn't, and at least Tarleton was dead now, so that he could never reveal the name of his partner in the scheme. All the tracks were covered, so to speak. No one would ever be able to connect the man at the desk with Clark Tarleton or the Southwestern and Pacific Railroad. A shame about the spur line, but he hadn't been all that interested in that part of the plan in the first place. As far as he was concerned, the idea was to cause enough trouble for Conrad Browning so that Conrad would turn to his father for help. That was exactly what had happened. Frank Morgan had come galloping to the rescue, as the man at the desk had known he would. And time and again, Morgan had been a hair's breadth away from death.
You cheated death again, Morgan. You're the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
The man at the desk was tired of living in fear. For 5 years now, ever since the death of Vivian Browning, he had expected to look up and see Frank Morgan in front of him, ready to claim his vengeance. Well, no more. No more. This gambit might have failed, but it was only the first move in the game.
Damn!
Inside the quiet, elegant office, with its dark walls and shelves of law books, Charles Dutton trembled with anger, and not a little fear.
Frank Morgan, it's time for you to die.
The Last Gunfighter, Savage Country, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2006, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Jeff Baker, Eric Messner, Ren Casey, Nathan Bennett, Jonathan Watkins, Christopher Graybill, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Amanda Thickpenny, Mort Shelby, Tony Nam, Dylan Lynch, Terrence Aselford, Tom Simpson, Stephen Carpenter, Jason Stiles, and Nanette Savard. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Ken Jackson. Book adapted for graphic audio by Jimmy Payne. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld and Brian Rogers. Original music and title theme by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed The Last Gunfighter, be sure to look for the series Sidewinders, as well as Smoke Jensen the Mountain Man, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. Keep listening for previews of other graphic audio thrillers.
Available now in graphic audio. Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist, Midwake, Part 2.
Sonar's picking up Soviet scout subs, Captain. But, sir, it looks as though their own island-class submarines are pursuing them.
Sonar, talk to me.
Sir, I've got 4 Soviet scout subs proceeding at flank speed, but rather erratically. I have 3 island-class, 4 island-class submarines in the classic Soviet pursuit formation. None of the island-class submarines is dragging a sonar array.
Very good, Lieutenant Kelly. Keep on it.
First officer, order battle station.
Aye, sir. Ordering battle stations now.
Now hear this. Now hear this. All hands battle stations, say again. All hands battle stations. This is not a drill.
Who the hell are you?
I am Captain Alexei Sarovsky of the Elite Corps of the Committee for State Security of the Soviet Union, under command of Hero Marshal Vladimir Karamazov. You are under arrest.
Sam!
Where are you supposed to bring me, Captain?
Comrade Major, have you no loyalty?
Oh, I have loyalty. But unlike your loyalty, it is not misplaced. This is a very fine knife, and I imagine it is very sharp. And if you know me by reputation, you know that I am very good with a knife. Either tell me where you are to meet Marshal Karamazov and when, or we will both find out together just how sharp this very knife happens to be.
You wouldn't.
Oh!
When land and sea collide, The Survivalist, Midwake, Part 2. Available now in graphic audio.
From the author of the critically acclaimed Elantris comes a beautifully crafted tale of dark intrigue, bitter rivalries, and powerful magic. order to save his kingdom of Idris from certain annihilation, King Dedalan must honor a treaty made long ago. He must send his oldest daughter to marry Suzabron, the God King of Alondrin.
War is coming, Your Majesty. They will attack.
If we send her, Yarda, we send her to her death.
Sending Vivenna is a poor plan, but it's our only plan.
Father, if we break this treaty, it will mean war. I am prepared to sacrifice for our people.
Lord God of Colors, forgive me. Vivenna, you will not go to wed the tyrant god of our enemies. I'm sending Ciri to your place.
Ciri, the youngest daughter of King Dedalan, soon finds herself plunged into a world of intrigue and politics, inhabited by undead gods and zombie armies. And she quickly learns that there is a darkness spreading through the highest order of Alondrin, threatening to consume all she loves.
Vessel, doing your duty as the vessel was the danger.
You have to tell me something.
You must not bear him a child. That is the danger. This all, everything here in the palace, is not what it appears to be.
Cursed with a lecherous form of magic which causes her to feed off the souls of the living, Princess Vivenna battles to save the life of her sister and prevent the war engine of Alondrin from crushing her homeland.
Your father and Lemix were right. The Alondrin have everything to lose by not attacking you.
I'm not going to become an Awakener, Dim. I might turn a blind eye toward that lifeless for now, but I will not awaken.
In the Court of the Gods, the highest authority in all of Alondrin, Lightsong the Bold, resurrected hero of ages since past, must come to grips with his newfound immortality as he struggles to unlock the dark secret of the Pantheon of Gods and their unstoppable armies of the undead.
What do they want of me, Larimar? Do they really think I'll do it? Lightsong the Selfish? Do they really think I'd give my life for one of them?
You offer hope, Your Grace. A last unlikely hope.
And if they're wrong, I have no desire to die. And why should it be otherwise? I mean, we have to die to heal one of them. We're gods to them only until they kill us.
And the key to halting the baying hounds of war may lie in the hands of the one man who wants to watch the world burn. Vasher, the Warbreaker.
Yeah. Are you here to free me?
No, Vahir. I'm here to kill you.
Don't miss Brandon Sanderson's high fantasy masterpiece, Warbreaker. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net.